Welcome to Primarily 2020, the podcast all about the politics, policies, and personalities of the 2020 Democratic primary. I'm your host, Karen Robinson. So I am delighted to welcome Travis Mooney to the podcast. I have known Travis for a number of years, actually, and we have one important thing in common in that Travis and I are both former vice chairs of Democrats Abroad UK. But I mainly know Travis from being what I always think of as the most enthusiastic Bernie supporter that I know. And it's in that guise that I wanted to get Travis onto the podcast today to talk about the case for Bernie Sanders. Thank you for joining me, Travis.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Always a pleasure. As I said, I know that you have been a very strong Bernie supporter for a very long time, but you and I have never really talked about how you came to be such a strong supporter of Senator Sanders and kind of what's behind that for you. So I'd love to hear your story.
Well, I think my support from Bernie stems from my upbringing. I was raised in a not terribly well-off working class business owning family. My grandmother voted Republican her entire life, including for Trump in her last election when she was alive. And, you know, one of the key components of the reason that I live in the UK and the reason that I support Bernie is Medicare for All and national health. When I was a kid, although we owned a business, we didn't have a lot of spare money. Being a small business owner is not easy. And we didn't really have health care. It was like paying cash when you go to the clinic. And if you had any drugs that you could take out of the sample box, that was about as good as it got. So national health and Medicare for All being a key component, of, especially in 2020, it is absolutely crucial to anybody I might support. And on top of that, you've got, you know, history from the 60s forward of social justice, racial justice, trying to push for the every man to and every woman,
every
to
person
do well in society, every person, exactly. And I think that concept of social justice is very, very important.
Yeah. 100%. Well, I totally relate to your admiration for Sanders' consistent support for a genuinely universal healthcare system. And certainly, like you, I so much appreciate living in a system that has national healthcare. And I think that the cultural disconnect that exists in America between the conviction that people have that in some way it would be damaging to them or bad for the country to just guarantee health as a basic right to every American citizen, it astonishes me, because in Britain you could never take it away. It's an article of faith here. It's so beloved, even while the system has its flaws and its imperfections and opportunities for improvement. But you know, they've established a real understanding that health care is a basic human right, and I look forward to the day when we have that same belief and understanding in America.
You know, the two biggest arguments I hear against a Medicare for All style system in the US are we can't do it. That's the first argument I hear. It's too big of a project. We can't do it. We've got in the US one of the most advanced bureaucracies in the world. If we set our mind to doing something, we can certainly do it. There's an economic argument as part of that can't do it mentality. You know, it's been shown time and time again that national health service style, Medicare for All style programs actually reduce costs. And the projections that have been done for Medicare for All actually show it costing less per capita than the current Medicare program does. And
the other thing is they say, oh, well, people like their insurance. I don't know anybody in the US who likes their insurer. They like their doctor. Perhaps they might like the healthcare they get, but I don't think anybody enjoys insurance. And, you know, you see the horrific markups that go on. I mean, just yesterday, obviously, I see a lot of pro Medicare for All kind of stuff, and Healthy California, which was an attempt in California to get single payer healthcare, and Colorado Cares and all of this. And there was a guy who posted his bill from the hospital where they gave him menthol cough drops individually packed, and it was a cost of $10 per cough drop. I mean, this is like hauls, and they take them out of the packaging, and they backpack them, and they take it from 45 cents.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I haven't lived in the U.S. for a long time, so maybe $2 for a pack of 10.
Yeah, just go down to CVS, each. Get yourself some menthol cough drops.
Exactly. But you can't do that when you're in the hospital, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's insane. And I think, you know, and I think more broadly, if you connect specifically that example to the wider kind of argument that Sanders is making about the capitalist system, I mean, Sanders describes himself as a democratic socialist. It's probably worth you saying a little bit about what that means, because a lot of it, to me, seems to come back to a lot of the problems that Elizabeth Warren has also identified, others have talked about, and just how non-functioning the U.S. capitalist system is at the moment.
Well, Bernie self-identifies as a democratic socialist. There's a lot of talk now about, you know, was FDR a democratic socialist? Is democratic socialism an equivalent or an analog to New Deal the New Deal Democrats? And I think there is in a lot of cases. We're not talking about radical systems when we view them from outside the prism of the United States. You know, national health and single-payer healthcare, for example, I mean, they have it in China.
Mm-hmm.
They have it in Finland. They have it in Denmark. There's,
I mean, to be fair, China is in fact a socialist state. But
well, that's true. But if you look
but at... But you're right. Denmark, Finland, Germany, Norway, even France.
Basically, every developed country in the world, yeah, except for the United States, has some sort of socialized healthcare. Is that a socialist plan? Absolutely it is. But is socialist a bad word? It becomes part of the question, because if you look to the history of the Democratic Party, every advance for the working person has come from the Democratic Party in the U.S. And these are programs like Medicare, for example, like unemployment insurance, the maximum working week, occupational safety and health authority. These have all come from the Democratic Party, and they are all socialist programs. Make no mistake about it. They are to protect the working people from being exploited. The question of, you know, can a socialist win, or is socialism a bad word? We have to kind of reframe the discussion to think these programs, which are some of the most popular programs in the U.S., they come from the same ground, right? So while I do take it that there has been a concerted propaganda effort to demonize the word socialism, I think that if when you look at a Scandinavian or Nordic or even European style democratic socialism, which is what we're talking about, we're not talking about command economy, we're not talking about some sort of terrible communist plot. What we're talking about is a return to the ideals that perhaps the top 0.1% shouldn't control more wealth than the rest of the country. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here, giving a fair shake to people.
Yeah.
Kind of not necessarily leveling the playing field, but at least giving a chance to start out in the race on a more equal footing.
Yeah. You know, there's more billionaires in the race than there are socialists. So the billionaires seem to be winning in every way, shape, or form in America today. There is, I think, a particular kind of moment in time that we're at historically where it feels like income and wealth inequality have reached a sort of tipping point or a peak. Do you feel like perhaps kind of people are more ready to accept and embrace and understand what that model of democratic socialism might make because of the way the world is right now?
I think the short answer to that is yes. The longer answer and slightly more nuanced answer is it depends on who you're talking to, because, you know, I've got family members that are, for their sins, they're California Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
They were Trump voters. Their taxes have gone up under Trump's tax plan. And yet somehow they still equate the Republicans with having more money in their pockets, and they equate Trump with doing something for them, which is very clearly, like, and empirically not the case. So
it's cultural, isn't it? It's
it, It is. It's cultural, and I don't know how we break that cultural mentality of, you know, tribal politics.
Yeah.
You know, although there's a social conservative bent in the U.S., which there isn't necessarily for, like, the U.K. conservatives, if the Republican Party were slightly friendlier to identity politics, I think that some of the people who are voting for the more moderate Democrats would lean their way instead. It's a very interesting situation, and people like my family in California, who, you know, they absolutely believe that the Republican Party will take care of them. The Republican Party is only taking care of billionaires at this point. So I don't know where they get this idea from, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
But it's this reputation for fiscal safeguarding has been somehow baked into the idea of the Republican Party, when in fact they're the spendthrifts, at least in modern times. I mean, since Eisenhower, they're definitely the spendthrifts, you know, spending without taxation. And when I say without taxation, I mean without taxation of major companies.
Yeah.
Look at Amazon as an example. I mean, what was it, $157 trillion or something like? I mean, some absolutely astronomical figure, and not a penny paid in federal income tax.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting, though, because, you know, as we've just said, it's the conversation is largely cultural and identity based rather than grounded in facts, because you're absolutely right. The economy tends to perform better under Democrats, even though everybody ascribes Republicans with being the ones who are strongest on the economy. You know, it's clear that investing in our country and investing in our people through better education, better infrastructure, better healthcare is actually better for the country as a whole, in all sorts of ways. But people do get very caught up in their sense of identity and their sense of an us against them politics. I'm curious, your California Republican family, what's their reaction to Bernie Sanders? You know, because he's been cast as being kind of on the extreme left of kind of acceptable American political opinion. I'm just curious kind of how they relate to him in relation to the rest of the Democratic Party, or do they just think all Democrats are beyond the pale?
Well, that's a very interesting question. For the people who are rabid Trump voters, I think that they don't. Well, let me just take one step back. I think that all of them, both my family who are rabid Republicans and my family who are some sort of Democrat or the independents for that matter, all of them have this belief, which has been very well carried in the media, that somehow Bernie is an outsider in the Democratic Party. Okay, technically he's an independent. He's running on the Democratic ticket. He's caucused with the Democrats for ages. You know, he's been around, and if not a registered member of the party, at least, you know, voting with the party for a very long time. The Republican supporting side of my family, do they view him any differently than they view the rest of the Democratic Party? I honestly don't think so. I think that they like what he says, because he talks about things being available for people. But I think that my Trump voting family members are so brainwashed that it doesn't matter if they will see a mathematical proof in front of them that shows that they will pay less for healthcare and have better healthcare than they do under whatever they've got now. Because sure, at the end of the day, they're going to think, oh, this massive program, it's going to take money out of my pocket.
Sure.
You know, these are people who chose not to enroll in the ACA and, you know, would just, quote, pay the fine if they got sick.
Yeah,
it's like the whole concept is alien to me. The flip side is my father, who's been an independent for many, 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 many years. I was on the phone with him last night, and he said, "When are you going to send me that Bernie T-shirt?" So I think that there is a populace that Bernie speaks to, who aren't necessarily party voting Republicans or Democrats. But draws both from the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and independents, where he says, look, I'm in this with you, and I want things to be better for you. And, you know, this is part of the song and dance that Trump did in order to become president is he went out to these places where a lot of white working class people had felt that they had been ignored for many, many years. And he said, I'm going to do something for you. Now, it turns out that by now, he actually hasn't done anything for them. And actually, their life is probably worse than it was when he came in. So I guess the corollary to your question is, can those people, not just my California Republican voting family, but can those people who supported Trump, will they believe that Bernie represents their values more than Trump does? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Bernie himself and where he comes from. Obviously, as you alluded to several times, he's had a long career in U.S. politics, and he's been, you know, around and active. You know, he was mayor of Burlington. He was in the House for a long time. He's been in the Senate for quite a while now. What are the things in his life or career that really stand out for you as kind of the signature, either moments of kind of clarity to understand who he is as a person, or the policies or achievements that he's pushed through that made you really think, yeah, this is a guy who gets it?
Well, I'm gonna paraphrase some of what his older brother Larry has used, because obviously he knows Bernie far better than I do. The fact that you know, Bernie's first election, he didn't win. Right. I think that was for president of the school body in high school or something like that. There were three guys running. And the story goes that the other two guys were very well liked, and they got up and they said that, you know, they would spend more money on the prom and this and that. And for anybody who's not a U.S. citizen, the prom is like a big fancy dance that we have at the end of the year. And Bernie got up and he started talking about the plight of Korean orphans as a result of the Korean War, and that he would use his platform as president of the student body to establish a fund to raise money for these Korean orphans.
How'd that message go down with the high school electorate?
Well, he came in third out of three.
Okay.
But the funny part of the story is that afterwards, the guy who did win president of the student body brought Bernie in. And they established a fund for Korean War orphans and sent, I don't know what the numbers are, and this was the 60s, so there, or even before that. So it's probably, you know,
sent
the dollar
some cash.
Figure, the dollar figure wouldn't seem huge to us, but they raised a lot of money for this fund that was Bernie's idea. I think that the whole concept that he ran and he lost, but he still had an impact. And then he ran again, and he ran for this. And he's not a quitter by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, when he finally won his race as for mayor of Burlington, you know, he won by 10 votes against a Democratic sitting mayor who was pretty lackadaisical, didn't really campaign all that much, thought it was in the bag. There was a Republican who helped split the vote. And, you know, at the end of that election, the Democratic Party, they weren't real interested in working with him in Burlington at that time. And they kind of wrote him off. They said, okay, he's going to be there one term. He's not going to get anything done. Then he went door knocking for down ballot candidates in the next election and got five of the 9 seats on the city council were held by progressives at the end of that. And when re-election came around, he increased his majority from 10 votes to something like 4,000. So it was a huge increase. And so the lesson we take away from that is that, you know, once he got his platform and his stage to say, this is what we need to do, his policies were actually proving to be very popular, and that resulted in bigger electoral wins. It's not like every race he won after that, though. I mean, he ran for governor of Vermont. He didn't win that. But, you know, he's been consistent. He's been tried to move things forward. And I think that, you know, regardless of how the primary goes at this point, we can see from 2015 to today the effect that having a public discourse about the ideas of democratic socialism has had on the Democratic Party. You know, you had the first candidate other than Bernie to mention Medicare for All was Kamala Harris, who, you know, as a former San Franciscan, I don't think anybody when she was district attorney would have called her anything near a socialist. I think it would be the opposite, quite frankly. So the Democratic Party itself seems to be realigning towards a center that is more left of where it was before. And the question really becomes, what is our moral compass and where does it end up, right? And I think that that's something that Bernie has been speaking to, you know, since he was in university, certainly, if not before that.
So throughout Bernie's career in Congress, he has always, he's running, obviously, as a Democrat in the Democratic primary. And as you pointed out earlier, he has long been caucusing with the Democratic Party and working alongside of the Democratic Party. But he has, until this point, specifically been very careful not to run as a Democrat. He has been nominated by the Vermont Democratic Party and then refused the nomination so that he could run as an independent. Now, I'm just curious your take on kind of why did he think that was the right way of going forward? What were the reasons why he felt it was important to maintain independence from the Democratic Party structure, so to speak?
Well, I think part of that, and I'm going to suppose here because I don't know what Bernie thinks privately, but I think part of that comes historically from the fact that when he ran for mayor, certainly, he was forced to oppose the Democratic Party because the party machinery was not supportive of him, was not supportive of new ideas, had their own pro-business candidates that they preferred to endorse. So I think part of it is that. Part of it is that he's maybe seen that the party is a little bit too cozy on the business side, especially in local politics. You know, and then once you've made your name as an independent, it's, I think, it's not easy to convince people that you're going to change from that. Now, that doesn't say that Bernie's trying to change what he's doing. That's just saying that I think that in a perfect world, yes, he would be a member of the Democratic Party, and that would quell a lot of the problems that we have with people saying, oh, he's not even a Democrat. For all intents and purposes, he is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, there's a big debate about this, how you ascribe it. But he does, I mean, you know, for example, as recently as 2018 with the midterms, again, as I described, he was nominated by the Vermont Democratic Party and refused the nomination to run as an independent, which in some ways was, you know, I kind of respect him for it because I truly respect him for a lot of things. But I respected the integrity of sticking with this is what I've decided to do. But I'm still not quite clear on kind of why, you know, what you're talking about with the local party politics was a long time ago. He, in 2016, ran as a Democrat very successfully. You know, he very nearly took the nomination. He had a very good run in 2016 and had a movement that he was building out. I just, you know, I've long wondered, and I, you know, it sounds like you probably don't necessarily 100% know all of his thinking either. Why not just take that moment to then say, I am fully within the Democratic Party fold and embracing this movement of which I am now an important part. And as you pointed out, somebody who's helping to change and evolve the party in many ways for the better. So, yeah, I mean, it's something I wonder about.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I'm not sure about that as well. And I've heard the argument from the other side that Bernie should refuse to run in the Democratic Party and should instead establish some sort of social workers, American Labor Party. You know, in 2016, Jill Stein offered to stand aside and let him have the nomination of the Green Party when he did not win the nomination of the Democratic Party. And I think that it's very clear that in the U.S. political system, especially in the presidential level, I hate to offend libertarians and the Green Party.
Oh, you can offend libertarians on this podcast. That's fine.
But they don't have a chance in hell of capturing, like, the presidency. There's no chance.
Yeah.
The money isn't there. You know, we had these Green Party members in 2016, and you know, as very staunch Bernie people, we had a follow-up event in 2016 after Hillary took the nomination. And we said, look, you know, everybody has to make a decision for themselves what they're going to do. But as social Democrats, as leftists, as progressives, whatever you want to call us, the majority of those of us who work in the campaign, we say, you got to get on board and support Hillary. And, you know, in fact, Bernie did, was it 32 events for Hillary in the run-up to the general, something like that?
Yep, he did. Quite a few. He was all over the place trying to, you know, there's lots and lots of speeches where he's saying, you know, if you care about all of the things that my campaign stood for, you must vote for Hillary Clinton. He was quite clear about it. And he's been very proactive in this election, too, in saying we must get behind the nominee, whoever that person winds up being, trying to sort of get ahead of that right now, which I appreciate.
Absolutely, because if we divide our side to the benefit of somebody else, then I think especially in 2020, Trump is going to have an easy reelection if what we call either the left or the Democrats or the progressives or any, if we're divided, it's just not going to work out.
100%.
But the flip side is, you know, people have said, well, why doesn't Bernie run as an independent? And the reason for that is that the two-party structure is really ingrained in American society. It's not easy to get ballot access to every ballot if you're a third-party candidate. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of organization. It takes a lot of money. And you know, the unfortunately, fundraising is a big problem, too. Right. Yeah. So Bernie could have very easily either taken the Green Party nomination in 2016, but that would have absolutely wrecked Hillary's chances, I think. Or he could be running as a third party candidate this time. But again, it would split the progressive vote away from the Democratic Party. And, you know, whether we like it or not, progressive and center left politics must be big tent politics. Otherwise, it's not going to work. We won't have enough votes to win these winner-take-all kind of things like the presidency in the United States. So, you know, it may seem annoying at times, but, you know, we're actually stronger for having a diversity of opinion.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, honestly, I think discipline is also probably a good thing to have in party politics. But we have to be able to bring everyone into the polls to vote for the common good. Otherwise, we're going to lose. And so I think that actually speaks to why Bernie is running in the Democratic Party, because it's the right place to be. And, you know, the kind of policies we're talking about, again, they are the policies of the Democratic Party, just maybe not the Democratic Party of 8 years ago or 10 years ago, but certainly the Democratic Party of the 40s and the 50s.
Yep. And maybe the 2020s.
Hopefully the
2020s. You raise a really good point about sort of creating a broad coalition and bringing a lot of people together, which is kind of, that's the structure of what the Democratic Party in America does, partly because of the way our system is set up. We have a first-past-the-post system. We don't have a parliamentary system. You know, you can only accrue power by winning in kind of outright plurality majorities in a number of districts and the presidency, et cetera, et cetera. So obviously, let's assume, as looks increasingly likely, by the way, that Bernie takes the nomination, because he's doing really, really well in a lot of the key states he needs to win for Super Tuesday. He has won the most votes in both Iowa and New Hampshire. So he is on track to perform extremely well and take the nomination. If and when that happens, he will then take over the leadership effectively of a party, because the presidential candidate is the leader of the Democratic Party for all intents and purposes, in which quite a lot of the people within the party have a different take on things. And certainly, you know, many of the people will have supported other candidates, will have, you know, I think there's actually a lot of common ground that all Democrats have, certainly on healthcare, that we all agree that healthcare should be a universal human right. We just have some different ideas about how to get there, but certainly he will be working as the leader of a party where a lot of people have a different idea about how to get there. I'm curious kind of how you would see him starting to pull all those different threads together and kind of turning that group into a unified coalition.
I think that's a difficult question to answer. you know, I think just to step back from it for a second, I was in California over the summer, my hometown or the nearest city. It's a pretty progressive kind of place. And I met a lot of people who would say things like, you know, I really liked Bernie in 2016 and I'm not sure now. But we just got to vote anyone but Trump. And I'm going to caution against that whole mentality, because the whole vote for anybody but Trump concept, we don't bring people to the polls by giving them something to vote against. We bring people to the polls by giving them something to vote for. Now, the question you've asked is, what do we think that we can do to bring the party together if Bernie wins the nomination? The same question has to be asked no matter who wins the nomination.
Because
no matter who wins, there are several losers.
Yeah.
And the people who've coalesced behind those candidates, and some of them are out of the race already, some of them are still in the race, they all have their ideas of what was important. Yang on universal basic income, some more pro-business candidates, Bernie on Medicare for all, blah, blah, blah. So no matter what, the big tent has to come together somehow. I think that even for a lot of the centrist Democrats, a lot of what holds them back from supporting something like Medicare for All is a belief that although that is what they would want in the end, that taking that step now is not likely to be successful. And I think I would disagree with that. And the reason I come back to this is I think those people naturally do support the policies that we're talking about in the Bernie campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the Democratic Party as a whole is going to have trouble getting behind Medicare for All. I just think that some of them think, oh, it's such a big jump. Can we get it done? You know, there's a former chair of Democrats Abroad in the United Kingdom who shall remain nameless. But I saw this person in 2016, and the statement that was given to me just after dropping the ballot in the box was, I would have voted for Bernie, but I just think that although I want Medicare for All, I just don't think we can get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer to that was, if you don't fight for it, you're never going to get it.
Sure, 100%.
So you know,
we got to move the window. You've got to make a start. You've got to get on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And to quote one of the founders of Israel, will it and it is no dream. You know, you fight, you put your head down, you work hard, and that's how you get from A to B.
Yeah. And in any case, you don't win, you don't make progress by surrendering before you start. I think, you know, I've heard Bernie make this case. I've also heard Warren make this case as well, that, you know, you don't start from your compromise position. You start from what you want, and then you do everything you can to get it. And you move as fast as you can towards it. So completely accept that. And I think, you know, I think you're right about what the rest of the party is thinking. I think there is, as I said in my question, I think there is a general desire for and belief that universal healthcare and ultimately a single payer system is where we would like to wind up. It's, you know, the policy works in other countries. There's no reason it can't work here.
But I think it's not just that. I think there's a general belief in the populace, not just in the party,
yeah,
that is something that people want. I think there's a general belief that the populace, that companies like Amazon should pay their taxes.
Sure.
Right? I think that there's a general belief in the populace that, you know, that people who are poor should have a decent education and be able to compete in the workplace along with the people who are more wealthy. I think there's all that. And I don't think that either in the party or in the populace that, again, I don't think Bernie's policies,
yep,
even amongst my Republican voting family, the policies are not what they want to fight about. Obviously, the Republican side of my family thinks that it's going to cost them more money, even if you show them it's going to cost them less money. I think the policies will bind us together no matter what.
Yeah.
And if we fall down fighting over party politics after a nominee is is named, then I think that that's a problem of that's our problem internally as Democrats, right?
It's gonna happen. It's our problem as Democrats, but it would be the country's problem if we couldn't get our act together. So, you know, whatever the outcome, we absolutely must get our act together. And I like your articulation of it. We have to be for something, not just against Trump. We are against Trump, but that's because we believe in a better vision for America. It has to be about that better vision. It can't just be about that guy's bad, because we all know he's bad.
Well, we all know he's bad. Some people think he's not bad. So there's an opposing viewpoint there in some other portion of the populace. But if the only thing you can point to is I'm better than that bad guy, you will not bring new voters, people who are disaffected. You won't bring them to the polls. That won't happen, right? They will sit at home wondering why everybody's getting so excited. If you give them, you say, your life is going to be substantially better and this is how we're going to do it, then, you know, you have a chance of bringing more people into the democratic process and growing the base. I mean, like all the things that we're supposed to be for, right?
So tell me that story, because I'm picturing it in my head. Okay, so it's the convention. We're in Wisconsin. Bernie stands up. He accepts the nomination. A huge cheer goes out. From now until November, he's going to be running a campaign to bring the whole country together, not just the party, but the whole country, together behind his vision for what, you know, why we can do better than what we have, why the future can look better than the present. What's it going to look like? What's he going to be doing? What should we be looking out for? What do you think are the strengths of his campaign that he'll be leading with?
I hate to hit the Medicare for All on the head again. Yeah. But I think guaranteeing health care and showing that it will cost less than most people's private health care, or almost everybody's private health care, is a key component. I think increasing access to education by giving some guaranteeing public schools will be tuition free. that gives something. But I think that the general message of social equality is what we're looking for. And I think that also he has to bind people together to realize that, you know, it's easy to say tax the wealthy, but the wealthy have very efficient tax lawyers, and that's why they don't pay any taxes. So it's not just that the government decided that Amazon shouldn't pay any tax. It's Amazon has tax lawyers who figure out how they don't have to pay any tax, and they pay the tax lawyers quite a lot of money, but a lot less than they would pay in taxes, right? And it's closing those loopholes, finding those loopholes, and doing it in a way that people understand is going to benefit the majority of the people. That's what we have to look towards.
Yeah.
I mean, the largest employer in the U.S., unless I'm mistaken, is Walmart. Walmart's the largest employer in 20-something states. The majority of their shop floor workers are not full-time employees and have no health care through the company.
Yeah.
And in general, I think the statistics have been proven that companies like that, and Walmart specifically, is the largest beneficiary of food stamps in the U.S. because their employees rely on it so much.
Yeah. So we can fix that. that would be a good thing to be for. Yeah. Travis, talk to me about Bernie's organization, because I know that for the past few years, since 2016, he hasn't been resting on his good performance in that primary. He's been building an organization. And I hear a lot of really great things about how active and enthusiastic and organized your organizers are. What does it look like from your side of things? Tell me how it works there.
Well, if you're talking about Our Revolution, which was a spinoff of the 2016 campaign, I think that Our Revolution has worked pretty well inside the U.S. especially. In talking about things like promoting social justice, different Medicare for All campaigns, especially on the state level, identifying people who are of a more progressive bent who are running for seats, that kind of stuff has definitely helped. And it's been very active. There are other offshoots. There are Justice Democrats. But, you know, nothing other than Our Revolution was directly tied to Bernie himself. Our Revolution's still running to the side. It's a issues-based organization mostly. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the people who were involved in 2016, including myself, and Eric Lee, who helps me run things here in the UK, you know, we went from the 2016 campaign into our revolution and then into the 2020 campaign. Because we see Bernie as the embodiment of the principles of the organizations that we were working in before he announced he was running for president again.
Right? And Travis, I see you out there. I see you out there on my Facebook feed. You're out there canvassing. You're meeting people on the street in London, thousands of miles away from the states where people are voting. What's that like? What is the feeling on the street?
You know, canvassing is a funny thing because, you know, we're in a foreign country and we're only really canvassing for American citizens.
Yeah.
We'll add anybody to our mailing list, but, you know, really we're looking for voters. And the response that we get is phenomenal. I mean, you know, if we send two people out on a canvas, you know, for 90 minutes to 2 hours, they'll come back with another 50 people for the campaign, which is amazing. But our candidate is very, very popular. The policies are very, very popular. And I think that a lot of people, we did well in 2016, but I think a lot of the people who are interested now are also interested because they see there's a very good possibility of winning the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a guy who I know socially. I saw him a little while ago. He used to work for the DNC in California. And I talked to him about joining the campaign. And he said, well, he wasn't sure, because he hadn't decided between Bernie and Biden yet. And I was thinking, deciding between Bernie and Biden, interesting, okay.
There's quite a few voters like that, though, actually. It's really interesting that quite a lot of the people who were supporting Biden, their second choice is Bernie, and vice versa. You wouldn't expect it. But I guess, again, it's cultural. It's not necessarily, people react to politicians in ways, sorry, I'm diverging here, but people react to politicians in ways that are outside of ideology. You know, they react to other person.
Absolutely. And I can tell you, though, that last week, after the Iowa results were more or less announced,
yeah,
and going into New Hampshire, this gentleman contacted me and he was like, I'm all in for Bernie. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Because there I think he saw that maybe Biden's campaign was not doing as well as he had hoped.
Yeah.
And out of the rest of the candidates, Bernie's his choice by far. So, yeah, I think that, you know, we canvass locally especially because people don't understand that they can vote locally.
Yeah.
People don't understand there is Democrats abroad, unfortunately. They don't understand they can vote in person. And, you know, the younger guys and girls, well, men and women, they don't understand that they can vote if they'll be 18 on the day of the general election. So, you know, we go to places where there are students a lot of the time, and we canvass there. We tell people about Bernie's positions. Most of them don't need to hear that. They already know it. Most of the people who come up to us ask us, what are you doing here? Because it seems odd to see a person with a clipboard and a Bernie shirt in the middle of London. And we explain there's a Democrats Abroad global primary. You can vote on Super Tuesday. It's super easy to do it. You can vote right here in town in person. You can via email. You know, the whole spiel that Democrats Abroad actually gives out.
Yep.
And those people immediately sign up to our mailing list and say, just tell me where to be and when. Because they are dying to cast their vote. But for one reason or another, sometimes they're students and they're only overseas for 8 months, a year. And it's not super easy to, if you're starting from scratch, it's not super easy to get your absentee ballot in time and return it and all that.
100%.
So, you know, and some places that, the county clerks are really notoriously bad. There are people who've never lived in the States but have rights to vote because they're citizens. They don't know how to do it. They don't know what address to use. You know, there's all these questions that pop up. But in the majority, you know, I think our candidate's very popular, and that part of the reason that people come up to us is because they're enthusiastic about him. But also, I think part of the reason people are just want to vote so badly and they don't know how they can do it, and they realize if they go talk to the person with the Bernie shirt on, at least they're going to find out how they can vote.
Yep. 100%.
Because they think there must be a reason that guy's standing over there in the cold in a t-shirt.
Honestly, it's the best work that anyone can do in politics. It's so rewarding when you help someone vote when they want to. It's just amazing.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the things I love about being an activist for Democrats abroad is we find votes nobody else can reach, right? And votes that are outside of the grid. You know, we're not showing up in anybody's polls. We're not showing up in anybody's canvases of their local neighborhoods. You know, it's additive. We're adding votes to democracy.
There was a really interesting moment about a month ago when 538, Nate Silver's publication, they released a poll of Democrats abroad, right? And we all just like
how do they do that?
All of us in the abroad campaign just started laughing. Because who do you call?
Yeah.
what phone numbers do you, like, whose house do you not, like, how could you possibly even come up with a sample of the Democrats abroad voting body? I mean, it's impossible, right?
Did we get to the bottom of what methodology they were using?
No. I did email them and I said, what? And they were like, yeah, well, you know.
No, I don't know. That's why I asked.
I don't know. I mean, like, I can read green papers and I can look at the historicals. Is it all historical based? I mean,
hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. But it was just, you know, but I remember in 2016, I did a final canvas on the Thursday of voting week. So because in London we have a vote on Super Tuesday, and then we had a follow-up vote on the weekend. So I did a final canvas on the Thursday before polls closed. And I saw people that I had met on that canvas come through and vote on the Saturday. And that honestly was... This is going to sound really dorky, but that was absolutely thrilling.
Oh, I totally feel that. It's the best thing.
Exactly.
I love it, like, I love it when
people,
voters show
you
up.
You see people and they're like, and they don't even remember you, but you remember them. And you're just like, that's direct political action right there. And that's, you know, there's nothing like that.
I totally agree. Listen, Travis, I'm going to give you a chance to make your best two-sentence pitch for Sanders, and then we can go ahead and play the gut check game. But would you like to have a think about kind of if I were trapped with you in an elevator and you had just 20 seconds to make your best pitch for why I should vote Sanders before I get off that lift and run away, what would you say to me?
Bernie Sanders is not only the most popular politician in the U.S., his policies are the most popular policies in the U.S., and he's the one that can and will defeat Trump.
Okay, I like the sound of it. Shall we go ahead and play the gut check game?
Sure.
So for my new listeners, I have in front of me my trusty Red Sox baseball cap, into which I have placed some slips of paper that have quotes, usually quotes heard from around the campaign trail. For this Bernie Sanders-themed episode of the podcast, these are quotations from throughout Bernie Sanders' life and work. I will pick one at random, and Travis and I will just react to it. So here is the first one. This, I guess he's talking about kind of, as we were alluding to in the podcast earlier, definitions of socialism. He says, you go to your public library or you call your fire department or police department. What do you think you're calling? These are socialist institutions.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. You know, we have to have some sort of, and you don't have to call them socialists, they're social institutions, right? Like they are for the public good, you know? And the fact that we have a police department and a fire department and a public school system and a public library system, these are all important cornerstones of our society. And without them, we would all be worse off.
Yeah. Yep. We've got to treasure our public goods and we need to build more of them. We don't have enough public institutions anymore. We certainly don't need less. More.
Absolutely.
Here's another one. Right. Okay. Here's a good one. It has become clear that the function of a private health insurance is to make as much money as possible. Every dollar not paid out in claims is another dollar made in profit for the company.
Well, yeah, this is a statement about the way business works. I mean, the whole point of being in business is to make money.
Yeah.
So, and in a shareholder-owned business is to return shareholder value.
Yeah.
So if you are in the business of healthcare or any sort of insurance, your goal is to take in as much money as possible while spending as little as possible. The health insurance industry, especially in addition in the U.S., it is ballooned up by the big pharma industry, by big medical. You know, this is why, you know, an aspirin's $27 or a cough drop's $10. Like, there's no chance that that's actually the amount of money that anybody is transacting for that in real dollar terms. But it's all buoyed up by this belief in kind of, you know, turning over cash and reflecting some sort of shareholder value. The whole point is that without healthcare, we can't have a healthy workforce. An unhealthy workforce, you know, drives overall profitability actually down. So if you're in big business, which hopefully some people listening to this might be in big business, like, you having an educated and healthy workforce actually makes your costs go way down.
Yeah. Healthy Americans are a public good. It's valuable to all of us for everyone to have healthcare. Makes you better, creates employees, it creates a healthier citizens, just over reduces public expenditure, it makes, you know, allows people to raise their children better. Every aspect of it is just makes life better for everyone.
You know, I had a very funny interaction on the canvas this week. This young woman said to me, she said, you know, she was reading this health report and it was, you know, there's always this narrative about the Mediterranean lifestyle, the Mediterranean diet, and, you know, Europeans live longer than Americans because they had a healthier diet. And it turns out that this study debunked all that. It said, actually, the best thing to help you live a long time is having regular access to medical care.
Yeah. It's like, what a shock. Doctors make people healthier. Huh. Funny that. Here's another quote I pulled out that I pulled it out because it made me laugh a little bit. He says, "I'm not always a smiley kind of guy." One of the things that Bernie sometimes gets criticized for being kind of a bit, you know, people say, "Oh, he's, you know, he's shouty or angry," but he's actually also really funny. And that's one of the things that I think, just from a personal point of view, I've taken away from watching him in a lot of debates these days. He has this really nice kind of truth-telling, you know, kind of no-nonsense-y, but like quite witty, bantering persona, which is actually kind of fun.
Yeah, I think people respect the fact that he's not talking down to them.
Yeah.
And that he's willing to provide what are, you know, to stand up to falsehoods and hold up for his side. So he may not always be the smiliest guy in the world, but he's undeniably funny. Oh my God.
He's funny.
I mean, if you saw him in 2016 with Larry David on Saturday Night Live, like sending himself up, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. He's quick and he's quick on his feet. You know, he comes back with pretty sharp in the debates. So, and again, which is valuable. Again, when you think about the fact Donald Trump has almost no redeeming qualities, but the one thing he is good at is being on television. So it does matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think I'll do one more. Here's one. He says, "The next time you hear me attacked as a socialist, like tomorrow, remember this. I don't believe the government should take over the grocery store down the street or control the means of production, but I believe that the middle class and the working families who produce the wealth of America deserve a fair shot, or fair deal," he says, actually. So that to me is like him defining democratic socialism, isn't it? He's saying, you know, forget what you've learned. This is what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the U.S., you know, we quite often conflate the Soviet communist style, which was not socialism in any way. It was an oligarchy run by a political elite.
It was totalitarianism,
exactly. We conflate that with socialism. And it's absolutely, it has nothing to do with each other. You know, a command economy is unfunctional, probably, and not what we've talked about at all in the campaign, nor do we want. You know, you have to have the ability to have small business be nimble. But the whole point is to allow people the opportunity to do things for themselves as well. Like, you know, it's funny. I have a friend who works in the Department of State. And a couple of years ago, he was talking about quitting his job because he didn't like it. And I said to him, well, you know, you've got healthcare right now? And he said, yeah. And he's got kids and a wife and blah, blah, blah. And he could not afford to quit his job because he couldn't afford healthcare if he did.
Yeah.
And it's not just him. I know lots of people who are stuck in their jobs because they can't afford to be out of them when, in fact, you know, not only would they maybe be happier doing something else, but they probably could be more economically active and bring more to society.
Yeah. And they would be more free.
Absolutely.
I mean, freedom should be the freedom to make choices that based on what's best for you and your family without feeling indentured and permanently a slave to holding on for dear life to a particular job, because it's not just the wage that you need, but basically the fundamental right to healthcare. They shouldn't go together. There should be no connection between employment and health.
Absolutely. And look, we're not arguing for you know, going to a system where people do nothing and they get paid to do it. That's clearly not what we're talking about at all. But, you know, there are certain issues that benefit society as a whole in their healthcare, their education, their access opportunities, you know, these kinds of things. That, like, if you don't have a more level playing field, we'll never have a super level playing field. We'll never have, you know, the child of a billionaire and the child of somebody who's homeless competing for the same, you know, job opportunity. That's probably never going to happen. But having a more level playing field benefits society overall.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to leave it. Travis, before we go, is there anything you'd like to say to Sanders supporters who are listening who might be thinking, how can I get involved?
If you're a Sanders supporter who lives abroad, please go to BernieAbroad.org and sign up for our mailing list. We'll send you all the information on how you can vote in Democrats Abroad. It is by far the most effective way you can vote for Bernie. If you're living in the U.S., find your local Bernie campaign office and get involved. You know, you can just walk in. You don't need to call ahead. You don't need to figure out who's in charge. Walk in, say you want to help, and they will help put you to work. If you'd like to travel around helping Bernie out, I just found out today there's an app called Bernie B&B, and Bernie B&B will help connect you with places you can stay if you want to campaign away from home.
Great stuff. All right. Thank you so much, Travis. It's been great to talk to you. And that's it. As always, you can reach me on Twitter. I'm at KarinJR on Twitter, KarinJR. If you are an American listening to the sound of my voice, please make sure that you register to vote or request your absentee ballot in this calendar year. Don't just trust that you're still going to be on the voter rolls. It's always a good idea to re-register to make sure that you get your ballot. You can do that at vote.org if you're an American back home, or if, like me, you're an American abroad, the website you need to go to is votefromabroad.org. I should let you know that on Friday we will be recording a debate recap episode of the debate that's being held on Wednesday night in Nevada, in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I will be recapping that episode with Emma as per usual. In the meantime, I should also let you know that this podcast is not affiliated with any other entity or organization. It's just me, and I wish you a very happy week.